Hello, and welcome to this PERspectives Continuing Education Podcast, created by healthcare professionals for healthcare professionals. PER is a leader in healthcare education and offers free accredited medical education programs in a variety of accessible formats at gotoper.com. Today's podcast is titled Considerations for Customizing Care Plans for Patients with Parkinson's Disease Psychosis. Patients with Parkinson's disease are often seen by neurologists and psychiatrists, so I'm speaking via telephone with Dr. Stuart Isaacson, a neurologist, and Dr. Gus Alva, a psychiatrist, about how they tailor their management for patients with this condition. To get us started, Dr. Alva, how common is Parkinson's disease psychosis?
This is something that's going to affect one out of two people that have Parkinson's disease. Oftentimes, I think in the past, in our desire not necessarily to engender fear in our patients, we wouldn't necessarily speak about additional non-motor symptoms that people might experience. So it's not uncommon before a diagnosis of Parkinson's disease is being made to see that long history of constipation, maybe excessive daytime sleepiness, people having REM sleep, behavioral dysregulation, or depression, even before the motor symptoms would set in. But then once the motor symptoms do set in, oftentimes they become the big focus that clinicians oftentimes will latch onto and not necessarily think about the fact that there could be an attrition of cognition as well as the onset of psychotic symptomatology.
Dr. Isaacson, do you have any thoughts about this?
I think it's really so common. And when we think about one and two, it sounds so high. But when we think about our patients as they go in the hospital throughout the 5, 10, 20-year course of the disease, I think we begin to recognize that patients often have these problems. They don't always talk about them. And I think it's really important to highlight this, that we really have to ask proactively to our patients and their caregivers if they ever see things that aren't there or have thoughts that aren't true that other people share, because it's really a symptom that may not be intuitive to a patient or their family members to talk to the neurologist taking care of their Parkinson's movement problems to tell them that they see things. They might go to an eye doctor before they ever make it to a psychiatrist like you.
So you're absolutely right, Stu. I oftentimes will preempt things with patients as well as family members or caregivers or loved ones that are actually with the patient that I'm seeing, that there may be the presence of illusions or hallucinations or delusions that might set in subsequently. And if they're not there right now, that's phenomenal. But at the first moment in which we start seeing the apparition of these pesky clinical considerations, then it's important to actually do something about that because it can become problematic. And certainly also, once the caregiver hears about these things, it becomes a ready avenue for early intervention, because sometimes there's frank embarrassment in being able to acknowledge that there's a symptom that's set in. Sometimes there might be forgetfulness if that individual also has cognitive flaws. And certainly also, if there's a greater focus on the motor manifestations of the illness, then we're not necessarily going to be getting to the core issue that there may be other non-motor symptoms that are now brewing and potentially creating great conflict with the interactions that that patient's having.
Yeah, I think that's so important to highlight these issues. I mean, in all patients, as we ask about memory and constipation, and do you feel dizzy when you stand up, and how do you sleep at night, and do you have any tremor, and how's your walking, how's your balance, and do you ever see things that aren't there? It's so important to, because I think it really destigmatizes the whole problem and makes patients aware and their caregivers aware that they should let us know about it if they occur, that it's not something that's so terrible, but it's something that we can treat.
What are some of the more common ways that patients present with Parkinson's disease psychosis?
So really something we have to focus on, and we have to recognize that the symptoms are most commonly visual hallucinations, but often other things occur first in the sense of presence or passage, where someone feels there's someone in the room or on the side, they turn, they look, but it's not there. This is a false sense of presence or passage. That's very common to occur first, and illusions, where there is a stimulus, a tree looks like a person, or a sock on the floor looks like a mouse, or a belt looks like a snake. These may be early signs that hallucinations will emerge, but indeed, this sense of presence and passage, these illusions, are symptoms of Parkinson's psychosis. It's not normal to see things that aren't there, and it's not normal to feel people are in the room, and it's not normal to have one stimulus look like something else when it occurs on a regular basis. So we really have to ask our patients about visual hallucinations, but also sense of passage and presence, illusions, and then other hallucinations. Because many of our patients experience auditory hallucinations. It may not be voice commands, it may be music or humming. They feel tactile hallucinations. Some, ironically, have olfactory hallucinations, even though there's the anosmia, loss of smell in Parkinson's. Some have smell hallucinations, and then delusions occur too, and these can be stereotypical.
Dr. Isaacson, how do these psychotic symptoms affect patients and caregivers?
Really can burden our patients and their caregivers, because especially having someone you love that you've been on a journey trying to treat their motor symptoms, now they're seeing things that aren't there. They're looking out the window and seeing an elephant out the window, and they're not eating their breakfast because they're staring out the window. Or they have delusions that the spouse is having infidelity and stepping out on them, or they feel that their caregivers are stealing money or food from them or poisoning their food. This can be very difficult to live with and very frightening also.
Absolutely. Imagine the burden that's placed on that caregiver, right? Typically, it's going to be a spouse, a daughter, son, close family, friend, associate. And if that individual is being blamed for something that they've obviously not done, or being, cast as, this nefarious individual that's, conniving behind the patient's back, that makes people feel put off. Not only is caregiving, genuinely a labor of love, it's oftentimes a labor that is time consuming, and it robs the other individual of their productivity as well. So, add insult to injury when now all of a sudden delusions set in where, the individual's feeling persecuted or hounded or, again, accosted by the individual that's actually trying to care for them. So when that pops out, it creates a great degree of friction. The dynamics between people can really, be very delicate. It's a fabric that can be readily frayed, and that's where it's so important for us to educate individuals accordingly.
Dr. Isaacson, how is Parkinson's disease psychosis diagnosed?
I see a lot of people, and sometimes they tell me they act out their dreams. They fight, they kick, they punch, and we know this to be REM sleep behavior disorder. It's a prodromal symptom of Parkinson's. It occurs throughout the course, and it's a risk factor for developing Parkinson's psychosis. Not everyone with that develops it, but something we often want to make sure we're asking our patients proactively about. We should ask all our patients proactively about delusions and hallucinations and early symptoms of Parkinson's psychosis. But when you see a patient with Parkinson's disease, and maybe you're seeing them for a mood disorder, and you hear they have REM sleep behavior disorder, how much do you go into trying to query them? And do you just let them bring it out, or do you ask them certain questions to see if they are experiencing any early signs of Parkinson's psychosis?
Well, it's really interesting that you mentioned that, Dr. Isaacson, because, when you take a look at, hypnagogic and hypnopompic hallucinations, generally, these are phenomenology that may occur as you're falling asleep or as you're waking up, right? That's not necessarily problematic or pathological, but it can sometimes be a little bit unsettling for people. But it's very important to distinguish between something like that and then frank hallucination. In the case of somebody with Parkinson's disease, we certainly note that the publication by Ravina et al. In 2007, Movement Disorders, gave us a really nice feel of the diagnostic criterion necessary for Parkinson's disease psychosis. And obviously with that, the very most important tenet is having Parkinson's disease, but then subsequently developing one of the symptoms, one of the core symptoms that you described, whether that be a passage hallucination, delusion, a hallucination or delusion, at least one of those, and that it's enduring, it's continuing, it's creating problems. There's been at least a month that, these symptoms have set in. Sometimes people retain insight, sometimes they lose that insight. Sometimes they can have cognitive flaws in conjunction with, sometimes they don't. But it's really important to note that this is actually going to progress and create great problems. And among the things that we have to take into consideration as a differential would certainly be the most common thing would be a delirious state, right? Where somebody has an infectious process and we can identify the etiology of that and correct it. But then certainly also if somebody has suffered with schizophrenia in the past, obviously that would be the explanation as to them having, you know, hallucinations or delusions. But, you know, we have to take into context that things don't happen in a vacuum. You know, we have multiple things that are going on. A mood disorder can present with psychotic features, whether that be bipolar disorder or major depressive disorder with psychotic features.
Well, it's important because we want to try to understand what a person might have. We want to be able to make an accurate diagnosis, and having a working group that included psychiatrists and neurologists and Parkinson's neurologists together making a consensus diagnostic criteria is so important. And it's also important to recognize, and often people are surprised to know that a diagnosis of Parkinson's psychosis can be made with just having illusions or just having a false sense of presence, and you don't need to have hallucinations or delusions present. But to make the diagnosis, you just need to have Parkinson's disease, to have symptoms of either illusions, false sense of presence or passage, hallucinations or delusions for 30 days and exclude delirium, medications, and other causes of it. So that's really important. You mentioned risk factors and RBD, REM sleep behavior disorder, cognitive impairment, although many people with Parkinson's psychosis don't have cognitive impairment, but it is a risk factor, vice versa. Actually, having older age, having other sleep disorders, having other mood or anxiety disorders are also risk factors for developing Parkinson's psychosis. So it really makes us have to monitor for these symptoms. And I don't know, do you use any screening tools? There's not really a lot of screening tools out there. There have been some proposed, but I think regular monitoring is so important.
What are other helpful hints that you can recommend for diagnosing patients with this condition?
Sometimes the symptoms may be infrequent and not something we may be apt to treat right now. But then you get a phone call and they say, well, for the past week or two, I've been having these hallucinations several times a day. And then this is very unusual. He was having them several times a week and they weren't bothering him. Now he's frightened by them happening multiple times a day. And I always look for what triggered it, because we know that Parkinson's psychosis reflects part of the degenerative process in Parkinson's disease is serotonergic hyperactivity, we think. And this is going on very gradually, but if someone is exposed to certain medications that may increase dopamine, it may be like pouring fuel on the fire, certain dopamine Parkinson's medicines like dopamine agonists and selegiline and amantadine may be more apt to trigger an increase. So if this medicine was recently begun, we'd want to withdraw it. Anticholinergics, antihistamines, Benadryl and over-the-counter sleep products can be a trigger. One of the biggest triggers I sometimes find is a urinary tract infection or other infection or metabolic problem like dehydration. Urinary tract infections are very common in people with Parkinson's disease because of changes in the bladder and autonomic dysfunction. And when they develop a subclinical infection, that may be manifest by not only worsening motor symptoms, but also worsening non-motor symptoms such as psychosis. So I'm always on a high highly suspicious of that and ask my patients to get tested for these things and to follow them up rapidly.
What about multidisciplinary management for these patients? Is this realistic and how is it best done?
Sometimes when a neurologist is taking care of a patient with Parkinson's disease and they begin to develop some of these illusions or even hallucinations, sometimes they worry, should they be referring them to a psychiatrist or should they just continue to follow them until they're bad enough to treat and then send them to a psychiatrist, or should they be empowered to treat them on their own and follow and know when to treat them? When do you think patients who have Parkinson's should be referred to a psychiatrist?
Well, I think it's a collaborative process, right? And I think that with the additional information that we have right now, you know, a lot of people can actually continue on to help out their patients as best they can. You know, prior to several years ago, we didn't really have ways of actually offsetting this in an appropriate manner. We didn't really have any FDA-approved medicines to deal with this particular clinical situation. We do now. But even with that, you know, there's still a fair amount of mythology that exists within our profession. Sometimes we've been rooted with, you know, utilizing certain things, and we're not necessarily looking at the advances that have been made, or think that, you know, maybe they're not necessarily as worthwhile since we've become familiarized with different approaches that we've had. I'd say that, you know, a referral is certainly always welcome. When there's, you know, two heads are oftentimes better than one. I oftentimes will state that to patients. And it's not a demerit to anyone to simply say, hey, listen, do me a favor, tell me what your thoughts are. And, you know, what would you be doing something a little bit different? So I'm glad you mentioned that, Stu, because sometimes I get patients that come in and say, they say, I don't know why I'm seeing a psychiatrist. I'm not crazy. And, you know, we oftentimes have to say, well, I'm glad to hear that. I agree with you. You're not crazy, but you have a condition that's evoking a certain degree of symptoms. And what we're going to do is we're going to figure out how to correct that as best as possible so that it's not intruding on your overall life experience. Anything that creates additional problems for people, you know, oftentimes, you know, suffuses the overall joy of life, and we certainly don't want that in our patients.
Once you've made the diagnosis, how do you initiate treatment for patients?
Of course, before we decide on medications, we always want to make sure there's no infection or dehydration, routine blood tests and evaluation, and we always look at the medications. I often have my patients put all their medicines at home, over the counter, everything they have into a big bag, and bring them into the office if they're having increased symptoms over a few days or a week or two, just to really get an idea of what they might be taking. They might not even be aware of what they're taking, because sometimes things aren't as they seem with over-the-counter things especially. And we want to look for these things. Of the Parkinson's medicines, first I'll lower dopamine agonists and then lower them and sometimes then discontinue them. Often amantadine and selegiline as well, if they're developing psychosis symptoms. We may have to think about long-acting versus shorter-acting levodopa preparations if these symptoms persist as well. But that therapeutic bind that you mentioned earlier, you don't want to take away too much dopamine medicines where patients can't move or risk of falling, because in Parkinson's disease, we're always increasing the movement medicines, the dopaminergic type of medications. And now we have non-dopaminergic types of medications and trying to help our patients live normal mobility lives. And as soon as they develop even early and infrequent delusions, we stop increasing as readily and we often start decreasing. This is very different than how we treat other people with Parkinson's who don't have psychosis. And then when we look at all the medications, we have to take away antihistamines, anticholinergics, sometimes for bladder, sometimes for sleep, make sure we don't have anything triggering it. And then we have to decide to treat. So whenever someone has that it bothers them, or if they don't have full insight and then they're affecting their activities or it's becoming more frequent and or more severe, I'm going to think about treating with adding an antipsychotic type medication. As a first-line therapy, I think.
Another group of medicines that we oftentimes run into with this patient population, especially our older population, are opioids. And sometimes, you know, these will actually create great impact with people too. But I would agree, anticholinergics, antihistamines, and certainly, you know, the way that we're addressing the motor symptomatology, the way that you spoke of that, obviously we would be addressing all of those things. And now having adjusted as many things as possible, you're absolutely right. The utilization of an antipsychotic medication would certainly be warranted. However, part of the problem is that antipsychotics, obviously, in the past, have classically been D2 blockers. And so if we think of, you know, tying up or, you know, depleting some of that hyperdopaminergic drive in the mesolimbic tract, that might actually be useful in reducing delusions and hallucinations. But the spillover issues are that as we hit the nigra striatal tract, we're worsening Parkinsonian symptoms. You know, we might also create additional problems as we hit the mesocortical and the tuberoinfundibular tract. So there are consequences associated with the use of antipsychotics. Now, the advent of the atypical antipsychotics, you know, steered in a new era where we also block 5-HT2A receptors. And the greater degree of 5-HT2A blockade, the less D2 blockade needed to be able to get that antipsychotic type of an effect. And I think that that also, you know, earmarked the pathway associated with the only medicine that's currently FDA approved for Parkinson's disease psychosis, which happens to be an inverse agonist at the 5-HT2A receptor, as well as being an antagonist there to a minor degree, 5-HT2C, but not hitting any other receptor.
I think this idea of using antipsychotics is such an important idea to think about, because in the past, traditionally, we've had to avoid antipsychotics in our patients with Parkinson's disease, because all antipsychotics that were available, in fact, all the ones that are available to date now, except for pimavanserin, all block postsynaptic dopamine D2 receptors and will have the propensity of worsening motor Parkinson's. So really problematic in trying to treat psychosis in people with Parkinson's disease. We used to be left with only two choices, three choices, I suppose. One, just let it be and ignore it. Two, reduce motor treatment. With three, add an antipsychotic that worsens motor symptoms. So really, it's been a big change in the paradigm of how we approach treating Parkinson's psychosis with the emergence of medications, antipsychotics, that don't seem to worsen motor Parkinsonism. And there's two that don't worsen motor Parkinsonism demonstrated in randomized blinded trials, clozapine, which was studied in 2 4-week trials. Both of these trials showed an improvement in psychosis without worsening motor symptoms. And pimavanserin, which was studied in a pivotal 6-week randomized blinded trial demonstrating efficacy and safety and tolerability in treating hallucinations and delusions without worsening motor symptoms. The only other antipsychotic that seems from small case series and anecdotal reports not to significantly worsen motor Parkinsonism is quetiapine, although one study suggested it might worsen motor Parkinsonism in up to about 15% of patients, so it has to be looked at. Quetiapine has never been demonstrated also to demonstrate efficacy in treating Parkinson's psychosis, but it's commonly used based on clinical experience and anecdotal information, but we don't have the evidence base to support it. It's off-label use, as is clozapine for Parkinson's psychosis, by the way. Only pimavanserin has FDA-approved indication for treating the hallucinations and delusions associated with Parkinson's psychosis. So I've considered pimavanserin to be first-line therapy for my patients with Parkinson's disease psychosis when I evaluate when I'm able to prescribe something a first-line.
I would definitely concur with you, Stu. The interesting thing, as you described right now with clozapine, obviously it's an older player. It's been around for quite a while. And even psychiatrists sometimes cringe at the thought of the utilization of clozapine because it does warrant a risk evaluation mitigation strategy. This is the one medicine that you could die of if all of a sudden you developed agranulocytosis. So it's very important that patients be being monitored on a weekly basis for the first 6 months, then biweekly the next 6 months, and then after that, every month after the first year of being on the medicine. But you know, this is really interesting because we're seeing an evolving panorama of where we're looking at maybe the most benign approach that we might approximate for our patients and educating not only them, but also their loved ones as to what to look for. All the medicines within this family carry black box warnings. Certainly also pimavanserin carries a black box warning, although it's adjusted, that specifically state that there could be an increase in morbidity and mortality because of cardiovascular or lower respiratory infectious issues associated with the use of these medicines. So it's critical for clinicians also to take into consideration which medicines might evoke sedation or orthostasis, which could also compromise the ambulatory state of our patients and certainly lead towards additional injury.
So even more recently, there's been a number of studies published that look at large databases, Medicare databases, commercial databases that have really demonstrated that people with Parkinson's disease who develop psychosis have higher mortality than people with Parkinson's disease without psychosis, that people treated with antipsychotics seem to have higher mortality. But when you looked at the specific antipsychotics, it appeared in these several studies that patients on quetiapine had higher mortality than Parkinson's psychosis patients on pimavanserin. That is, pimavanserin was associated with a lower mortality than patients on quetiapine or other antipsychotics. And some other recent publications suggest that there's a lower risk of falls and hospitalizations in patients on pimavanserin for Parkinson's psychosis than those who were prescribed quetiapine for Parkinson's psychosis. So a lot of emerging information that supports the FDA indication and the role of using first-line therapies with pimavanserin. Clozapine is an effective treatment, but as you point out, the risk of agranulocytosis requires a registry for patients and prescribers, weekly blood tests for 6 months, biweekly for 6 months, and monthly thereafter. And for this reason, perhaps, is hardly used, less than 2% in the United States.
Once patients start on a medicine, what role do neurologists and psychiatrists play in monitoring them?
Well, I'm so happy that you asked that, because that may be part of the folly associated with why clinicians sometimes will reach for a given medicine to try to placate some of the underlying, behavioral issues that pop up because of the psychotic symptomatology in patients. Oftentimes, the thought is that the utilization of medicine that's going to be more sedating might actually be a good idea. The problem with that, though, is that we don't necessarily want our patients to be overly sedated, particularly if their ambulation is already compromised. And so it's almost folly to actually follow that particular path. But as we mentioned earlier, we didn't necessarily have many options in the past. And the good news is that we're going to be seeing additional aids in the near future that won't necessarily have a heavy-duty impact on D2 receptors, but also are pretty good at quelling psychotic symptomatology. So I would absolutely concur with you that a first-line treatment would be pimavanserin right now. But the reality is that the medicine doesn't work right away. We oftentimes see that there's going to be a lag of a couple of weeks before we start seeing some benefit associated with the medicine. And oftentimes family members or caregivers want results yesterday and don't necessarily want to wait, and oftentimes are eager to see a change, and that's not happening. And so there's a fair amount of coaching and encouraging that needs to be done to let people know that, this is something that's going to be building over time. And ultimately, we might be seeing a decrease in the frequency and severity of the Parkinson's disease psychosis that the patient suffers from. But it's a matter of educating individuals and having patients up front, which might mean that we might need to consider other things as adjuncts in the meantime, as opposed to the approaches that we had before, where we'd actually give a medicine and misinterpret benefit for really the reality of the side effect profile associated with the medicine, basically knocking down the patient, and as a consequence of that, maybe quelling some of the symptomatology.
Well, it's really important to coordinate this care, because there's only, everything centers around a person living with Parkinson's, their family, their caregivers, and they need to be aware when they start a medicine, as you point out, the when we expect to see improvement. With pimavanserin, for instance, it may take 2 weeks to see some improvement, and more improvement in 4 weeks, and full improvement by 6 weeks. It's important to recognize, and it was surprising for a neurologist who uses pharmacotherapies to improve movement, to recognize that it's not just pharmacotherapies to improve psychosis, much like we incorporate in Parkinson's disease movement care, wellness strategies and exercise and mindfulness. Also, when we treat Parkinson's psychosis, we have to complement pharmacotherapies with other strategies to enhance the effect and to do this, improving sleep, for instance. And what are some of the things that you focus on?
I definitely do the exact same thing, Stu. You made mention appropriate hydration, appropriate nutrition, physical activity, as well as mental activity. When we can engage people, actually be doing some physical therapy, get moving, get ambulating, and so on in a safe manner. Sleep is oftentimes one of those things that gets overlooked, but it's so critical.
Thank you for joining me today to answer these questions about Parkinson's disease psychosis and how we can work together to provide better management for our patients with this condition. Thanks for listening to this PERspectives podcast. If you like today's episode, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening.